have come so far, so far from home. We have come so far, so far to go. Hey, Kayla.
Hi, Blake Strode. We are back.
We are back. Hello to our listeners. Welcome back. Welcome back to Under the Arch.
It's Friday for us. It's been a long week.
Yes. But a beautiful week also. And like, you know, it was supposed to be very stormy. We got a little rain, but it's bright. Sun shining. You know, it's comfortable. It's not too hot. Like, this time of year is really lovely.
Yeah. We've definitely made the weather change, and work is like unique because so many things are happening. It's budget season in the city of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. It's legislative session still in Jefferson City. Mm-hmm. It is officially spring, which means we are like in the hundreds of days to the election. And, you know, it's just a lot happening. April really is this huge transition month as we think about quarter two. And so I'm happy to be on this podcast because I'm wrapping up my work week. And this is the last thing I have to do before a weekend of seeing my niece off to prom and all the things that come with spring.
Aww, you know, isn't that exciting? Beautiful.
It is exciting. I'm very, yes. This is my like last, you know, prom of a nibbling.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm years away from my nibbling's prom. But that's very important. That's beautiful.
It's a very exciting and expensive time. Shout out to all the
people. Yeah, right.
So,
yeah, but as you were giving that like rundown of stuff happening with the budget cycles and the, you know, state legislative calendar, I feel like one of the things that we're always trying to do on this podcast is keep track of all of these various sites of struggle and sites of contesting for power. And we've really been looking forward to the topic for today because particularly, I don't know, our guests can sort of correct me or tell us more, but it just feels like particularly in the past several years, we've just seen this real resurgence of energy around labor fights and labor struggles and big wins for labor in those fights, which has been, you know, it shifts everything. It shifts the economic conditions of people that are engaged in that fight. It shifts politics in a really important way. So I'm definitely excited to dig in.
Okay, well, let's jump into that topic. Our guest is here watching us banter through these first couple minutes of the podcast. Jeremy Alhaj, welcome to Under the Arch.
Thank you for having me. You all have such nice chemistry together. I didn't want to interject, you know.
Oh, you know, it's lovely to together all the time.
Yes, you've been doing this for a long time. Episode is designed for your extended interjection, Jeremy. So cool. I'm going to read your bio so folks know a little bit about you. Jeremy Alhaj is the founder and executive director of the Missouri Worker Center. He was a founder and principal organizer of Stand Up KC, the Kansas City arm of the National Fight for 15 movement. Over 8 years of organizing, Stand Up KC developed some of the strongest fast food leaders in the country, built out a broad base of community support throughout the Kansas City area, and won a statewide minimum wage increase for all working people in Missouri. So there's just really, there are not many better people in the world to have a conversation about workers and labor in the state of Missouri. So, Jeremy, welcome. Really glad to have you here.
No, thanks for having me. Yeah, thank you.
So, you know, the first question we always ask is just tell us a little bit about your story and how you got into this work.
Yeah. So I grew up in Virginia, actually. I'm not from Missouri originally. I'm a Missourian now, deeply, but I grew up in Virginia. And I grew up, you know, I was like, I'm Palestinian kid, you know, grew up in Northern Virginia, right around 9/11, lots of Islamophobia going on. My family's like slapping American flags on basically anything that they can, you know, trying to prove that they're, you know, they're not one of the bad ones, quote unquote, you know? And so for me, that was like this kind of like awakening moment where I like started to understand, you know, oppression and race and class to a degree. And I went to college and, you know, I was hanging out with all these weird people, started reading some stuff, you know, had some ideas about being a radical and this kind of thing, and knew about labor unions and wanted to work for one. And, you know, Virginia is in the South. People forget because it's so close to DC, but that's the South for real. And there's not really a lot of labor unions in Virginia. So I started working for this organization called Working America, which is an affiliate of the national AFL-CIO, which is the biggest umbrella of unions in the country. And it's like a, you know, it was like electoral work. I'm out knocking doors in suburbs all over America, you know, trying to get people to vote for quote unquote labor friendly candidates, people who are going to, you know, do things about pocketbook issues. And then in 2010, I was working in Michigan and, you know, the Tea Party wave kicked off, which I'm sure Blake and Kayla, y'all remember that. It was, you know, like in my hometown where I grew up, you know, my neighbor, I remember my neighbor threw one of those Gadsden flags up in his front yard. Don't tread on me. Stop talking to my family entirely. Just cut us off. The, you know, there's people like marching around my neighborhood. They've got like, you know, an effigy of President Obama and they've got American flags and they're chanting about taking their country back. And the organization I worked for at the time, they didn't want to talk about that. They just wanted to continue talking about bread and butter economic issues. And we lost. We got crushed everywhere. And so I left. And I'm not going to lie. I was broke. I didn't have any money. I had an unemployment check coming from Pennsylvania, which Pennsylvania, shout out to Pennsylvania, has pretty high unemployment compensation. And my partner at the time was from Kansas City, and that was cheap. So, you know, it was kind of met in the middle. Had this nice unemployment check and this cheap place to live. At that time, it was cheap. And so I moved to Kansas City and I got involved with the Occupy movement shortly after moving there. All these people were throwing up tents in public parks, taking over public space, in protest of, you know, banks getting bailed out during the financial crisis and the widening wealth inequality in America. I was involved in that movement and that's really where I started to learn how, like, real hard organizing skills. So I started learning community organizing. I met my mentor at that time who taught me labor organizing, and we started to work on different projects. One, to try to root out, you know, right-wing elements that had were cropping up in the movement because, you know, there's lots of far-right people who hate corporations just as much as I do, but, you know, we don't jive on everything, and, you know, they were, they definitely showed up in that movement, and so we were trying to root those elements out, trying to connect the movement back to like organized labor, try to figure out like real demands we could leverage in the city. And then the cops bulldozed the whole thing over, you know, they came in with their bulldozers and that was the end of the Occupy movement. And so coming out of that, we started a series of different projects around like the local utility company, around, we had a blog, like a working class blog where we interviewed people about just like working class life in Kansas City. And then there was this moot push from President Obama to raise the minimum wage to $9.80 an hour. And so we started organizing workers in Kansas City around that push. Like, can we win $9.80 an hour? And people thought, oh, that's crazy. That's nuts. $9.80. Man, you're talking about a $2 raise on the minimum wage. And then these workers in New York walked off the job, like 200 of them. And they said, well, actually, we want 15. This $9.80, that's not it. We want $15 an hour. We want a union. And we already had this committee of workers in Kansas City who were organizing. And they said, well, we want to be part of that. Like, forget about your 980. We want to be part of that. So we became part of that movement. And I worked there for 8 years organizing fast food and retail workers as part of the National Fight for 15. Took workers out on strike so many times. I can't remember how many times. Organized with some really amazing people I still organize with to this day. And then after Donald Trump was elected in 2016, really like the union, SEIU, the Service Employees Union, which was the major benefactor for the National Fight for 15, had to reassess some of their political priorities. And Missouri, as we all know, was a place where political victories were hard to come by. And so they started to remove resources from here. We cut our staff pretty significantly and I moved up to Chicago. I started working for SEIU Local 1 on this project to, win for fast food workers, something called sectoral bargaining, which would have meant like, instead of like, I negotiate with my employer, I'm going to negotiate, with the entire industry. And the city is going to help to be this middleman. Then the pandemic happened. I moved to St. Louis. My partner at the time was from St. Louis, had a child. So I moved back here. And Stand Up KC, this project I'd spent so much time working on, was like dying. Like, it was just one organizer. He's treading water. He could barely survive. So we got together, me and him and another organizer, we got together and we founded the Missouri Workers Center in order to bring new life to Stand Up KC, figure out new strategic direction for it, hire more organizers. We spread into the St. Louis area, started organizing with Amazon workers over here. We started working with dope organizations like Action St. Louis, and we started working on statewide policy projects. And that's kind of where we're at today. So,
wow, yeah. What a journey.
Yes, so much organizing. Just a true bread and butter organizer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't, this podcast is not a visual medium, but I'm... Listeners, this man is not 80 years old. That was like a lot of stuff he covered. You know, that's a lot of movement. I also really appreciate you touching on so many moments in history, because you're right, these things kind of get wormholed in our memory. So when you talk about that Tea Party moment, which we've like forgotten about because of everything that's come since, and the Donald Trump, and then of course Occupy, and then everything that's come out of that. So it's fascinating to hear you sort of situating your own journey around those kind of flashpoints, and landing, of course, in the Missouri Workers Center. Can you tell us a little bit more about Missouri Workers Center and the mission of the organization?
Yeah, so Missouri Workers Center is a statewide organization of low-wage workers that are organizing and fighting to win good jobs for all Missourians and to fight racism. And the reason we link those two things together is because we know that, you know, historically, looking at the labor movement, race has been the Achilles heel of that movement. Dividing workers along racial lines is how employers have destroyed the labor movement. For decades. And so if we're going to rebuild the labor movement and revitalize it, race and fighting racism has to be at the forefront of that. And so that's really the mission of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's so important, because when we think about this sort of evolution of work in this country, you do just have these defining moments where, like you said, race is this dividing line around whether, you know, you're thinking all the way back to like the Jeremy and I were actually this week, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. 2 days ago.
It was 2 days ago. Yeah. Jeremy had a session with Heather McGee, who is author of The Some of Us, and she talks about this. And one of the things that she mentions as a clear example is, in the National Labor Relations Act, is that the right piece of legislation?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the National Labor Relations Act, that the two sort of categories of workers that get cut out from all these protections and the establishment of Social Security are farmers and domestic workers, who are predominantly, is a field that are predominantly Black. And so then you just continue to see examples of the sector creating more protections and expansions and opportunities, but there's this racial line that really stops those same opportunities from being accessed by Black people and people of color. And so when we started thinking about that national picture, Jeremy, can you talk about like Missouri specifically, how, you know, the labor movement has changed over the years in our state and the sort of conditions that workers are facing now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it differs depending on which side of the state you're on. You know, like Kansas City and St. Louis, I think, have a lot of things in common. I don't normally say that out loud in the company of St. Louis folks, but like, I'm going to put it out there. I think there's a lot of commonality between Kansas City and St. Louis.
So we're in the same state.
You are. You are. But I mean, the reality is that labor in Missouri has been on a decline, like it has everywhere nationally. You know, basically since 1955, the labor movement has been in decline. And so it's just been trickling out members ever since. And Missouri is a place where that's been true. Missouri is down, You know, at the height of the labor movement, we had 1 in 3 workers were in unions. Today in Missouri, it's like 1 in 10. So, you know, that means that 2/3 of workers in America were without a union. Now it's like 90% of them. So like 90% of workers don't get to talk about what their wages are going to be or their benefits or, you know, what kind of schedule they're going to work. They don't have any way of protecting their job. Most, you know, I don't even know if you can apply for a job with a pension anymore. I don't even know if that exists actually anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that like in Missouri in particular, like Kayla, you talked about like agricultural workers being cut out of the National Labor Relations Act. And that's like that's actually like a big piece of Missouri's history. The Southern Tenant Farmer Union was extremely active in the state of Missouri and in Southern Missouri in particular, where tenant farmers were organizing to win better conditions, to win better pay so that they could buy their own farms, have these subsistence farmers instead of having to work as tenant farmers. They actually at one point erected tents all along major highways in Southern Missouri. And people from St. Louis, like inner city folks from St. Louis, came down and were actually standing with them to try to fight alongside them. They were ultimately like, crushed, you know, as a lot of movements are. But that is part of our history. And in Kansas City, actually, like people talk about the sit-down strikes in auto plants in Detroit. Auto workers basically kicked management out, took over the plants. They locked the doors, sat down. You know, they had these like women's auxiliaries that were, you know, at the time, women didn't work in the auto plants, which is not a great part of the history of the labor movement, but it's the truth. So they had these women's auxiliaries where women were actually like, they were actually fighting cops. They're like busting windows out. They're throwing, you know, they're like bringing food down to the plant and sneaking it inside so that the workers can eat. And there are these like really militant working class battles that ended with powerful unions that won some of the best jobs in America. And Missouri, Kansas City, that was the first place where there was one of those sit-down strikes, actually, in northeast Kansas City. And that auto plant is gone now, right? Now you go to the northeast in Kansas City, there's nothing, there's really not much in terms of jobs. But there used to be a whole section of that area called Leeds, where there was lots of manufacturing. All of that is shut down now. There was a steel plant there. It's gone. You know, all those jobs have just, they were taken from those working people and moved to places where they didn't have to pay decent wages or treat people with any kind of dignity and respect. You know, our cities have paid for it, you know, like same thing in St. Louis. When you look at parts of the defense industry, parts of, you know, like the history of the Funston nut pickers in St. Louis. I mean, there was like these militant labor struggles that won good jobs for people all over the state because of the ability of corporations to pick up those jobs and predominantly move them. Not, I think people oftentimes think about those jobs moving overseas, but actually it was just, they moved them a couple hundred miles south to southern states where the racist leadership of those states had crushed the labor movement right alongside the civil rights movement and were able to keep unions out and then therefore keep the conditions low, keep the wages low, make sure that capitalists in the northern part of America could keep raking in profits and not have to deal with workers who were organizing along cross racial lines side by side. So our state now, it's, you know, it's deindustrialized. Like, you know, the biggest industries in our state now are like healthcare, the university systems. You know, like I know every time I turn around, SLU and WashU are buying up more of the city. You know, it's, you know, this is the, these are the big, you know, things in our state now. And not to mention like Walmart. And, I mean, Walmart's the biggest employer in almost every state in America. So.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful sort of painting of the historical picture around, you know, labor. I don't know what we might call labor relations broadly over time, and sort of how the power dynamics have shifted over time. I would love, before we started recording, I said, you know, we have an outline and then we deviate. This is a bit of a deviation, but I would love for you to do just a little 101 for us on a couple of things. One is, you know, we talk a lot about labor and unions, and I think we kind of take for granted a certain amount of understanding about what that really means. So I would love for you to kind of give us a bit of a 101 on like why the structure and strategy around unions and unionizations has been so key, what that really
means. You spoke to it a bit just now, but would love for you to say a bit more about that. And then I have a question about strikes, which are such a key part, have been such a key part of union strategy. But yeah, just to talk a bit more about unionization generally.
Yeah, I mean, there's really like two major kind of legacies of unions in America. There's kind of the craft and trade unions that I think people mostly think of, you know, like they think of like construction workers. Those unions are different really than like a lot of the legacy that I talk about when I think about unions, because those unions were actually built to be exclusionary. They were like their entire model is to exclude people from the labor market so that they can have a monopoly and demand higher wages. That's how they operate. The legacy that I look to is the legacy of the industrial union movement and the service unions, which is a different legacy. And it's, you know, really required inclusiveness. So it required like white, black and brown workers to stand together in order to win. And that's because of the strike. So I'm just gonna go out and talk about the strike anyway. But
yeah,
like, so unions are really like the way I define a union for people is a union is just an organization of workers that comes together to use their strength in numbers to get things done together that they can't get done on their own. And often what that means is that they've got to withhold their labor power together. And that's what a strike is. It's just when workers say, we're not going to do the job that you want us to do. We're going to collectively say no, and we're going to leave the job. We're going to walk out. We might sit down on the job. There's a number of different ways they do it, but often people walk out and they refuse to work and they set up picket lines and try to stop production at whatever employer they're at. That's the goal. And the reason you do that is because, you know, factory or restaurant or retail store or, you know, distribution center, if they're not, you know, moving product, then the owner's pocketbooks are going to hurt. They're going to lose money. And that's how you hurt them and make them do the thing that's going to be good for you, the worker. And so workers do that, and then they form that. That's actually like them acting as a union. And then what they're really trying to win is recognition of their union from the employer. So they want the employer to say, yeah, I recognize you guys have a union. We should negotiate with you. And legally what that means is once the employer has recognized the union, they have to sit down and negotiate a contract with the workers. And that contract is how you consolidate those gains. And usually the contracts last between 3 to 5 years. Then you negotiate a new contract, and the contracts will cover everything from like wages, benefits, disciplinary measures, health and safety. Workers have also used those kind of like negotiations to negotiate for other things too, like affordable housing and like environmental procedures. And like they've negotiated, you know, like there's great stories about the March on Washington movement in St. Louis back in the 30s and 40s, using those types of negotiations to negotiate to actually break down the color barrier in jobs. And so it's, so, you know, there's a lot of ways that workers, when organized and they're able to exert leverage in the economy because of their collective power, that they can use that leverage to win all kinds of different things. And it's really, I think, an overlooked part of our political history. I think a lot of times we think about elections and we got to get these politicians to do this thing and blah, blah, blah. But these corporations got a lot of power and we can hurt them too.
Well, I know if you're like me, you're listening and you're like, I'm learning a lot, because Jeremy is both good at giving you current context and these historical moments that bring you this very clear picture of how workers have created through sheer force and organized and relationships like changed the very fabric of what we understand the work landscape to look like today. And so we're going to take a break because we have to. We got to pay the bills. We don't have bills. We don't have bills on the podcast, but we are going to take you to our music minute. And on the other side of that, we'll be back with Jeremy to continue to talk about worker movements and how we can get involved. You're listening to Under the Arch.
So high, but you're close.
Welcome back to Under the Arch. We're still a podcast where we explore the issues facing our communities and the people fighting to transform them. You just heard Meant to Be by Tech Supreme for our podcast Music Minute. You can find all music by Tech Supreme wherever you stream your music. We were talking during the break, and now we got to bring the break, as always. We got to bring the break conversation back to the podcast.
Yeah. You were just giving us this great, 101, as I requested, on unions and unionizing, and then the importance of strikes in the context of unions. And one thing you said earlier in the conversation that really stood out to me was this experience you've had of taking people on strike, of sort of being at the outset and helping to steward people through those moments of being on strike. And I would love to hear you just kind of paint a picture of what that entails. What does that require? From your perspective, from the perspective of workers that are taking that kind of momentous step, what does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes people hear like you're going to go on strike and they think like there's some like legal checkbox you have to hit before you can do it. And so they, people think it's like harder than maybe it is, I think. But it certainly is like emotionally challenging. Like I remember working in Kansas City as an organizer on the Fight for 15, which was really where I like cut my teeth as an organizer. It's where I learned a lot of the stuff I learned. But there was this Burger King that I used to, Fight for 15 is all fast food workers. So there's this Burger King. I used to organize this Burger King and I would sit in there like all the time. I'd just be in this Burger King all the time, like in the parking lot. I'm just there all the time. I might as well work there. And there's this worker working there named Terrence, who's still part of the organization. He's like on my board now. He's like big leader now. He's great. But at the time it was his first time ever engaging with anything, going on strike, any of that. And Terrence was like a real shop floor leader, and for me, like for organizers, labor organizers, right? Like leaders are like these organic people. Like I think a lot of times people think that like a leader is somebody you pick one and then you're going to like imbue this person with leadership. And now they're like, they exist. And for us, it's like, they're there already. You go find them and you're really just trying to activate them in the campaign. And so Terrence was there. Terrence knew all his coworkers, knew all their stories. He signed up everybody in the Burger King to be part of the movement. He's like, we're going to take everybody out on strike. And it was the very first strike any worker in Kansas City had ever gone on, any fast food worker had ever gone on. And we had this whole plan set up. We had Reverend C.T. Vivian came to town. I don't know if y'all know, Reverend C.T. Vivian mm-hmm. from Tennessee. He came into town and he like did this prayer circle with the workers and blessed the strike. We had Congressman Cleaver like spoke on the strike line. We had this whole big thing planned. And Terrence is supposed to be like the speaker for the day. Like he's the person who's holding it down because he's the leader. He brought everybody out. And I remember sitting with Terrence the night before. I picked him up from work. I'm going to like take him home. We're going to talk. And Terrence is sitting in my car and his hand is just like, you can't see me. People can't see me. But his hand is shaking like hard, like visibly. He is scared talking about this. And I asked him, like, which are you more scared of? Are you more scared of your manager, this lady Rita, who had these big old bug eyes? She used to hate me. She had big ass. But are you more scared of Rita being mad at you or being angry with you or even doing something to retaliate against you? Or are you more scared of another 10 years of this industry not being able to feed your kids or pay your rent or keep your lights on? Which are you more scared of? And he, of course, said he was more scared of the latter. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think that's really what it is for people. Mostly, it's like, you got to make a choice. I mean, do you want to keep on living the way you're living, or do you want to fight for something better alongside your coworkers? And if your choice is you want to fight for something better, then all you got to do is not go to work. That's it. That's easy, And then, we can do all kinds of stuff when you're not at work. We'll have a march. We'll have like a picket line, Like I said, we'll get Reverend Vivian to come down. It'll be cool. But if you walk in those doors and you go to work that day, you are now the enemy for your coworkers, because your coworkers are going to be outside and they're going to be trying to shut down the store. They're going to be trying to stop production. And you're going to be inside making burgers and running the cash register and keeping that place running. And, you got to pick a side. You can't be in the middle anymore. And that's really the power of a strike for workers. It's like, it defines kind of the terrain. And so he went on strike, been going on strike ever since. I think he's been on strike like 16 times or something now. It's been a lot of strikes, a lot of different places. He's great.
I remember my first solidarity strike was at a McDonald's in St. Louis with the Fight for 15 crew here. And it was after, or sort of during, it was after Mike Brown was killed, but during the uprising. And just this intersection that you mentioned earlier, this like how we sort of think about race and class having to be in constant conversation if we're actually going to build a movement that's going to transform systems, and how these movements actually influence each other. And I don't think you get the scale of uprisings in these same places where there are like Fight for 15 workers and Fight for 15 organizers and leaders who are like the same folks who are working in, you know, the McDonald's or the Burger King, are the same folks who were in St. Louis were constantly being over policed, right? And targeted through the municipal structure here, and knew the very reality that we all witnessed on August 9th, 10 years ago. And so I just think that's this really, like, 515 has been this very influential movement of, and has helped to sort of seed other movements. When you think about somebody like Rasheen Aldridge, who I met as a Fight for 15 leader, who tells his story often of working at the Jimmy John's and taking his store on strike, and then being one of the voices in the uprising, and then being a member of the Ferguson Commission, then being a state representative, now being an alderman. It's one of the like clearest journeys of leadership development and clarity in how to take your individual story and build real power around it. And so can you just, you know, speak to some of the like material impact of the Fight for 15 movement? Cause I think it surrounds us really.
I mean, I don't know that the minimum wage in Missouri right now, I think is $12.80, but like, I mean, most of these employers are paying 15. And I think, I mean, like it really like has set a standard in the country around like what a living wage is. And, you know, like truth is 15 is not enough anymore. 15 is not. And, but it is like a standard that these workers set that standard, like workers like Rasheen and Terrence and like the thousands and thousands of fast food workers across the country that went on strike, shared their stories, like really fought to make that a standard. And it is. And, you know, there are tens of millions of workers who have gotten raises directly from the Fight for 15. I mean, over 30 million in the United States have gotten a raise because of minimum wage increases that are directly attributable to the Fight for 15 movement. That's a fact. In Missouri, hundreds of thousands of workers have gotten raises. And like, the truth is, like, I remember before the Fight for 15, like I said, I was like young, radical dude, interested in unions, wanted to be part of something like Occupy or the Fight for 15 or Ferguson. Like, that's the stuff I was like interested in. And it was not happening. Like, there was nothing. And labor unions were not out organizing, and they were not going on strike, and they were not fighting for more. In fact, they were doing the opposite. You know, this is like coming out of the Great Recession in 2009, 2010, labor unions are giving up concessions. They're giving up wages, and they're giving up benefits, and they're giving things up because they think, you know, it's this national crisis and they're trying to do their part. And these corporations were really just getting over. That was the truth. But, you know, people wanted to do their part to save, you know, the U.S. economy. And it was a noble effort. But that's what was going on. People are like giving up concessions all over the place. And some of that stuff we still haven't won back. You know, like the UAW just won back what they gave up during the recession last year. Like, auto workers just won that stuff back. So the Fight for 15 was this like the idea of like workers in, I think at one point, workers in 300 different cities across America all went on strike on the same day. 300 cities. Like, the idea of that kind of breadth and scope of a movement of workers that are taking on real corporate enemies and winning victories. And people who are like, I mean, these are like some of the poorest, most vulnerable workers in America. And they were walking off their jobs and going back to work the next day. Like, as a working person, like, I used to work in restaurants. Man, I'm sure y'all have worked in restaurants before. I remember I worked at Subway.
I worked at McDonald's.
People walk off their jobs all. I walked off the jobs before because I'm like, man, forget this. I'm out of here, you know? And most of the time, those like individual acts of rebellion, you don't get to go back. Even if you regret it the next day, you can't go back. You're fired. You're gone. People walk off their jobs, had rallies in front of their workplace, talked about their boss and their management and their corporation in the news, and then walked back onto their jobs the next day. For these workers, this like class of workers, that was like, I remember that was like this transformative experience that like created this kind of new militant working class in America that didn't really exist at that time. And I think, you know, that kind of builds us into this moment we are at now, where like Starbucks workers have won unions in like 400 stores. And a lot of that's built on the back of the Fight for 15 movement. It's really like, I think it really was the thing that kicked off, that was a wheel that turned the wheel for some of the labor resurgency that we do have today.
As someone who has not worked in fast food before, maybe an uninformed question. I know, never. I swept some racquetball courts was my first job, but I did not work in fast food. But what is the, when in those moments, is the negotiation primarily with, you know, national, international corporate? Is it with franchise owner? Like, what is the site of that contest?
It's both. I mean, it really is both, right? Because the truth is that the fast food industry is not really in the business of selling food. It's a real estate industry, actually, which is like this, it's like real estate and it's marketing. That's what the industry really is. And then these franchise owners, you know, there are, don't get me wrong, there are some franchises that are these massive corporations that are exploiting the life out of workers and are terrible companies. Like, what's this guy running for governor? Humra or whatever, this Wendy's guy. Anyway, that guy, like his company, massive company. They've got all kinds of, like, they are a bad employer. Like, I've got workers in my organization who have had horrifying experiences working for that corporation. But there are a lot of these franchises that are small businesses actually, and are having and the margins are slim. They're small. And these franchises, so the franchise owners are paying royalties back to these giant corporations that are mostly owned by finance capital. Right. And as finance bros are getting over and they're squeezing these franchises between workers and these corporations at the top. And so you had to win from the corporation in order to get anything significant. Like, if you were going to get anything that really transformed workers' lives, you had to get these corporations like McDonald's and Burger King, Wendy's, Taco Bell, you know, Yum Brands, Pizza Hut. You had to get them to move money back down to the actual shops, the shop floors. And if you couldn't do that, then the workers weren't going to be able to negotiate for enough to actually change their lives and improve their lives. And so the theory of the Fight for 15 was always like, yeah, we can win safer working conditions right here by going on strike. We can win a security guard, or we can stop them from, you know, we can stop the manager from harassing us and things like that. We can stop these things that are going on right now on the shop floor. But if you really want to win jobs that are going to transform the lives of what are majority poor Black Americans, then you're going to have to get these national corporations to come off some serious money. And that's why it was such a big national movement. And that's why, you know, that's why it took 10 years. I mean, like, we could have filed for elections at a Burger King at any time, but it would have been, it really wouldn't have meant much, actually. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have done much for people. It would have been really self-interested for us to have done that. So.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I remember the day I was watching television, and this is a transition moment to a question I wanted to ask. And an Amazon commercial pops up, and it's like, we start at $15 an hour. And I was like, I had a moment where I was like, I know the people who've made, I know some people who were a part of the public campaign and narrative work to make this the standard, right? And so, and then it was like, and Target said it, and then Walmart said it, and then, you know, and I drove past a Jack in the Box and they said, we're starting at $13.90. And I was like, might as well make that $15, it's right there. And so there is this like real moment that you started, you see that workers have had power outside of unions, right, to yep. demand an increase. And at the same time, you have these sort of like the organizations like ours who are fighting for the law to match up with this private sector organizing that's happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I bring up that commercial specifically because Missouri Workers Center has been doing a lot of organizing around Amazon in our state.
Yep.
And, you know, can you tell us about what that work has looked like?
Yeah. I mean, that work really started in December, was that 2019, when the tornado touched down in Edwardsville, Illinois, and hit Amazon's DLI-9 warehouse, took the lives of 6 workers. You know, we started talking to workers immediately, you know, like we had just, I was the only employee at the Missouri Workers Center. We had just launched publicly. I had like a bunch of volunteers and I had one contractor, and like we went down to the warehouse and we started talking to people, and what they started telling us was that, you know, Amazon was forcing them to come back to the warehouse, even though there was a tornado warning, that Amazon told them they couldn't leave the warehouse, even though there was a tornado warning, that they didn't even know there was a tornado warning because they were up on these lifts that were 30 feet in the air, and they made them leave their cell phones in the lockers, and they didn't notify people that there was a tornado warning. So all these like really like, you know, these red flags about like what had happened there. And when we started to dig into it more, what we found out is actually like OSHA doesn't, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, who's the federal agency respond, like that's tasked with protecting workers on the job, doesn't actually have standards around wind safety. And, you know, like Edwardsville's in the middle, you know, it's like Tornado Alley, and there's no wind safety standards. And so we started working with Congresswoman Bush at that time to wind safety standards, and to win, you know, as, you know, climate change continues, those types of events are going to be more commonplace. And so workers need, you know, in climate emergencies, the right to leave their jobs and the right to, you know, be able to go and do what's going to be in their own best interest and to protect themselves. And so she introduced 2 pieces of legislation in response to that. And we worked with her on those things. And kind of in the course of that organizing, we started to talk to some workers out in St. Peter's at this warehouse called STL8, which is the largest fulfillment center in the state of Missouri. It's semi-automated, actually, which is kind of weird. It's not, it still has 3,000 workers that work in it. At its low points, actually, it gets up to like 3,500, 4,000 workers. It's the size of 18 football fields, which is kind of hard to imagine unless you're like standing in front of it and you're like, whoa, this is this massive facility. And I've been organizing fast food workers for 10 years. So I'm like, this ain't McDonald's, you know, this is, you know, and,
Mama, we made the big leagues.
Yeah. I was like, whoa, this is a big place. So there's like thousands of workers in there, and we started to meet some workers, who were very angry, at the company. You know, we found out, you know, the workers started telling us that after 3 years, their wages were capped. Yeah, they might start at 15, but once they got, they, you know, by year 3, they're at like $18 an hour, and they will never receive another raise, no matter how long they work there. That they, every single day outside of that facility, there's an ambulance outside taking somebody out in a stretcher because it's so dangerous working there. That they have, that even when you are injured at Amazon, they have an in-house medical team. It's called AmCare. And when you go to AmCare, they give you an aspirin, they might give you an ice pack, and they send you back to work. So I remember there was one worker, we had the first action we had with workers at Amazon on the Missouri side, because we did a couple of things on the Illinois side after the tornado, but on the Missouri side, we did an action out in Robertson, Missouri, where right outside of Hazelwood, there's like a logistics park there. It used to be a town, and now it's like the whole thing was, they used eminent domain, bought up the properties, turned it into a logistics park. There's like one church left in there. This guy, Reverend Osby, he's still down there. Real nice guy. And he told us actually that, you know, the Amazon warehouse down the street, he's been like calling them and he's like upset because Robertson is a, there's a, it's a nuclear waste site, and people in his church have been getting cancer for years from drinking the water. And he's been trying to warn the Amazon workers and Amazon's not doing anything about it. So he thought, you know, the water in this STL-5 down the street from him, those workers were in danger. And so we had this event down there at his church, and we were going to march, and then it started. There was like torrential thunderstorms, like so bad. Like you couldn't even be outside. You couldn't see outside in front of you. So we all piled into his church, and we're in this church basement, and we got this white worker, this guy, Jake, and he's got this story, and he starts, you know, we give him the mic. He's like, he's prepped. He's got to tell a story. And it's basically, he was working as a water spider is what they call it at Amazon. It's like this job. They call them water spiders because they never stop moving. And really what you do is you're prepping stations. So you're like setting other people up to be able to do their job faster, because Amazon's constantly clocking you, right? They're clocking how fast you're working. They're clocking how long between you doing different tasks. They're clocking like how long you're away from your station. Like if you go leave your station, go to the restroom, you got a certain amount of time before you got to be back, or they automatically write you up. Like just the level of surveillance is really intrusive, and they use it to like really rapid speed up production. That's how they get a package to your door in one day. It's not like a mystery. It's like they working people to death. That's how they do it. And so Jake was working as a water spider, and he's like moving up and down the line. He's like pushing totes. He's like getting everything prepped, and he feels this tear like in right here in his chest, in his, yeah, I'm pointing to my pectoral muscle. He like feels a tear there. And he goes to the in-house medical, and they tell him basically like, you're fine. It's just a strain or whatever, you know, here's some aspirin, go back to work. So he goes back to work. He's in a lot of pain. He goes back to them. Eventually they let him leave. He goes to the doctor. He finds out he's got a torn pectoral muscle. Like it's torn, which is like, I don't know if y'all ever torn a pectoral muscle. It's like excruciating. He's like in a lot of pain. And they tell him, you can't work for a week, you know, and you got, now you got medical bills. And because he didn't go to Amazon's workman's comp doctor, Amazon's doctor that they have contracted out for those events, he actually was liable for his own medical bills, even though he incurred the injury at work. So this guy's got medical debt now. He's out of work a week, and Amazon could care less. So he's telling this story. He's angry. He's like, that's why we need a union. That's why we need it. That's why this has got to happen. And then he's got his Missouri Worker Center t-shirt on. And this white worker from St. Charles, I swear, he tears his Missouri Worker Center t-shirt off. And I'm like, what is this guy doing? Oh my God, what's going on? You know? And he's got a Dr. King t-shirt underneath. And he's like, and that's why we need equality. That's why we all got to be treated equal. Like that's what Dr. King meant. He meant that we all got to have a good life, like everybody. And this is white worker from St. Charles. And it was like this really in a black church basement in a place that was historically poor black people, that was bulldozed so that they could build a logistics park on top of it. And it was just this really kind of interesting moment, I think, politically for me. And it helped me realize kind of like what the power of organizing Amazon really could be, which is that there are few workplaces in America today that bring together people from places like St. Charles with people from places like North County or North City, with people from even like, we had workers from Farmington, Missouri, who were part of the organizing committee, who were driving an hour up to work at Amazon. You know, like there's not a lot of places like that in America. And so this warehouse in St. Peter's is drawing together all these different kinds of people and kind of mixing them up together. And we started having organizing committee meetings, and people would show up to these organizing committee meetings. And we had like, you know, I remember there's like, you know, we got like Black workers from North City. We got like queer workers who are like socialists. They're like, yeah, we've got, you know, like conservative white workers from St. Charles. And then we had workers coming in Trump hats, like Trump 2024, like they're like rocking their Trump gear, but all of them wanted to organize together, and they want to win a union together, and they want to stop getting treated like dirt, and they want to make more money. And so they've got this common interest, and that's like this basis by which you're able to start to talk to people about politics and about what's really in their interest and about white supremacy and racism and how that divides them from other people and about the surveillance state and all kinds of things. And so it's been this like really interesting project for us because it's rural and urban and suburban and Black and white and brown. And it really is this multiracial cross geographic movement of workers. And it has a lot of political potential, I think, to really, yeah, I think if those workers are able to, which, you know, it's not really up to me, it's up to them, you know, how much they're willing to fight. If they're able to win a union and to have a permanent organization with that kind of character, I think it could actually be something that really contributes to turning this into a more equal and democratic state.
That's amazing. I mean, that's just such an amazing, inspiring picture, you know? Like we sort of talk about that kind of cross-racial, cross-cultural, cross-geographic solidarity. But, you know, frankly, it's not nearly often enough we get to see it. So that's really an amazing story to hear you tell. I wanna switch gears a bit and ask a question from a particular vantage point. Like, to me, one of the an elephant in the room around this conversation is also that the three of us also happen to be heads of organizations, right? We also, among other things, are employers and run organizations. You know, it's a little different. It's a little different than maybe the classic case. We run nonprofits, we have boards, we don't own anything, but like we are responsible for workplaces, we hire people, we shape conditions. And so my question for you is, how has the experience that you've been describing, the many experiences you've had, your values, your politics around these issues, like how does that inform your approach as an executive director and as an employer yourself?
I mean, I treat my people pretty well, you know, and I'll say like, I'm lucky in terms of like, I'm not an executive. I mean, I am an executive director in title. I'm going to say this. I hope none of my funders listen to this. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not like, that's not really what I'm about, you know. Yeah. I'm an organizer. I've been an organizer. I'm the executive director stuff. I lean on a lot of people to kind of help me through that and to navigate how to do that properly. Yeah. I like to think I do it properly. And I think that, and I'm lucky because I've known so many organizers and so many good people in Missouri for such a long time that I can go to a lot of different kinds of people for advice. And also most of the people that work with me at the Missouri Workers Center are people I've known for a very long time. Like they're mm-hmm. like, it is like in a way, you know, this is like my chosen family. These are my comrades, you know, I'm like organizing with my comrades mm-hmm. and I'm very lucky to be able to do that. Because I've worked at other places where I wasn't, and it's all right, you know, but this is like a unique opportunity for me. And so, you know, I treat people, you know, people are treated well. And like, we have, you know, good, like, man, when I started as an organizer, I made, and they hate when I tell this story, the like young organizers, like the ones that are like, shut up.
But, in my day, we walked through the mud.
Yeah, they're like, shut up. Yeah, I'm like, I made $22,000 a year for like 3 years. You know, this isn't like way back in the day. This is 2012 or something like that, 2013. I was not, you know, the question for us was like, because we're just taking, you know, I think we took like one salary from the Service Employees Union and turned it into three salaries. We're like movement people were coming out of Occupy, you know, people were living in tents. We're like, I'm living in this house with like 15 people, you know, it's just like a different moment. And like, so it was just like, what do you need to make it? Well, here's what I needed to be able to pay my bills and just barely survive. That was the question. Yeah. How can you just barely survive? That's not what's happening anymore, you know? And I think that's a good thing. I don't think people should have to just barely survive to do this work. And actually, I think it's part of probably, you know, I've got a lot of critique of the left. I think anybody who's on the left should have, I consider myself a leftist. Anybody who has is on the left should have critique of the left because we are losing. You know, we are not winning in America. So we should really be asking ourselves why. I think one thing I always hear is, oh, we don't have any talent, you know, like it's so hard to hire people with talent and like people who have got good organizing skills, you know, we can't hire the right kind of, we don't get the right digital people, you know, like all this kind of stuff. And well, they pay more, you know, that's the reality. Like they pay a lot more, you know? And so if we really, I think, honestly, I think if we want to have effective organizations, then we need to actually think about how to compensate people in a way that is competitive. Like forget, like, is it right or wrong? Is it moral? Like we got to compete with these people because, you know, I don't want all the good digital people going and working for the Google. Far right. Yeah. Yeah. Google. Yeah. For that matter. Right. Yeah.
Us either. We got a digital person named Johnny who helps us run this podcast.
Yeah.
Man, we need Johnny.
Do need Johnny. Wow. And you know, we're about to get ready to, you know, land the plane. It's almost the end of the shift on this podcast. I'm corny like that. That wasn't funny. I didn't do it. I didn't nail it. Okay. I want to add, we always end asking, like, for folks who are listening and who are like, I dig Jeremy. I dig this worker organizer. I'm a worker and I'm going to organize in my workplace. Like I, you know, I'm interested in this. How can folks get involved with you this year? And I'm sort of allying to for your OOP because there's a big opportunity coming this year to change wages again in this state. And we've talked about it before on the podcast with Richard Von Galan. So shout out to Richard.
I listened to that episode, actually.
Yeah, shout out to you for listening. Richard. Shout out to Richard. But how can folks get involved with Missouri Worker Center and what's going on this year?
Sure. Let me just say, Richard's getting a lot of shine off this podcast. So next time he's on a podcast, I better hear my name come up at least a few times. So there's this campaign called Healthy Families, Fair Wages, which is, for me, it's a culmination of like a decade of work. You know, like workers have been fighting for 10 years to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. In Kansas City, they actually did it. And the state government came in and took it away. And in St. Louis, workers won, increased the minimum wage and they took that away too. And this campaign is actually, you know, workers can win, are going to be able to win $15 an hour through a statewide ballot initiative. And grassroots groups like my organization, like Kayla's organization, have gathered over 180,000 signatures on our own to put $15 an hour and earn sick leave on the ballot. And so what that would do is it would raise the minimum wage gradually to $15 an hour by 2026. And it would mean that working people in this state could earn up to 7 days of paid sick leave, which, you know, it's, to think that we went through an entire pandemic, like a global pandemic where millions of people died from an illness and where some working people had no paid time off, like no ability to call in sick and still be able to pay their bills. Like it's unconscionable, actually. It's like, it's really, I think, an indictment of our culture. And so I think this is a really important initiative. And, you know, we're hoping that it lands on the November ballot. And if it does, you should go vote yes. You can come volunteer with the Missouri Worker Center. You can knock on doors, get people out to vote. Go to moworkers.org. You can sign up on, you can contact us there. It'll probably come right to me because, you know, we're just a little grassroots organization. So I answer that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's one way to get involved. I think the other ways to get involved, I mean, Amazon workers in St. Peter's are organizing. They're continuing to organize and they're planning for some big stuff this summer. And so keep on the lookout for that. They're going to be taking action and they need the support of the community with them, because that's how they protect themselves. That's how they protect their coworkers, is by having strength in numbers and having people standing with them. So those are the two big ways.
Beautiful.
Thank you for that, alley.
Yeah, that was a beautiful alley-oop. So we are coming to the end. We have one more question. It's a vision question. We like to land in vision questions. Mm-hmm. And that is, what does a society that is pro-worker actually look like to you?
I think what it looks like is a society where working people make all of the decisions about their own daily lives. Mm-hmm. It's a society that's truly democratic, where workers have control over the economy and are able to make those kinds of decisions for themselves.
Well, we know you are bringing us in your work with others, your collective work with others. We know is every day fighting to bring us closer to that vision, and just really appreciate your work and the heart you bring to it, and really appreciate you coming here and sharing with us about that work and with our listeners, and has had an impact here, and know it'll have an impact for all the folks who get to hear this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you all for the opportunity.
Thank you, Jeremy. We really appreciate you. I just feel like we've gotten so much closer in the last 14 days. We've put so much time together in the last 2 weeks. And what I'm really excited about is a space that is organizing. You said, like, work is a place where many of us, most of us, go, right? And so it is a site where we get to see diversity, we get to see different lived experiences, and a place where we also have a very serious collective interest. And so I'm excited to see Missouri Worker Center continue to grow and change this state for the better. So thank you so much for joining us on Under the Arch. We're going to take another break, like really quick, and then we're going to come back to run the credits. You're listening to Under the Arch.
All right. Welcome back. Welcome back to close out this fantastic episode. Just wrapped that amazing conversation with Jeremy Alhaj. And I really enjoyed that. Hopefully you really enjoyed that. He's such a great storyteller, just a gifted storyteller.
Which is like what happens when you've been organizing for such a long time.
Yes.
You become this like Thanos collector of the Infinity Stone stories. And you're like, yeah, I can, and you visually can just see it. And I think worker organizing, we talked about this when we were on break, but it really is a section of the type of organizing that is so impactful and so important, because you really are meeting people in a space where this is their material need to take care of their families, and they have hopes for something more, but they're also making choices in real time about their livelihoods and their stability. And, you know, to be able to do that for such a long time as he has and build organizations around it, I think is really powerful.
Yeah, I agree. And obviously, you know, shaping the social, economic, and political context all at once. I'm very glad that he spent some time with us, and that he brought all of those insights and all those experiences and amazing stories with him.
And listen, let me tell you about, I am drawing a blank on who our first episode was. No, it was Mallory. So we've had Mallory, we've had Dara, we've had Nick, and now we've had Jeremy. Yes. These are leaders of organizations that are in our state, specifically in our region. Mm-hmm. And so you, our listeners, what we hope that you just continue to here are opportunities to show up, to get involved, to find a political home, to engage in work, whether that's food justice, worker justice, reproductive justice, community development. There are just so many opportunities in our city, in our community, and so many people doing good work, like really amazing work.
And speaking of opportunities to get involved and support that work,
nice.
Thursday, May 9th is Give STL Day 2024. If you're listening to this podcast, I know that you know about Give STL Day. It's an opportunity to support much of the amazing work that we've been talking about, that you've been learning about in these episodes. Our humble organizations fundraise on those days as well. Mm-hmm. Please throw a little love our way. You can get your friends and family. I love Give STL Day because it's such a like peer-to-peer collective fundraising, you know, small dollar kind of day. And it's and beautiful. You just feel the love.
Every donation matters. $5, mm-hmm. $10. It matters because it adds up. And, you know, I am of the school where it's like, I'd love to have 200 small dollar donations.
Mm-hmm.
That just shows the investment inside the work. So, you know, maybe this weekend, or maybe you've been saving your Taco Tuesday fund is now your Give STL Day fund. We are so appreciative of it. And look forward.
Lord, I need a Taco Tuesday fund?
I have a Taco Tuesday fund.
Wow. I got to think about that.
Because I actually, as I become an older millennial, you know, when I approach 35 in the year, I go out on, listen, I'd rather get it done on the weekday, go out, have my mark, have my salsa, my good storytelling gossip, and then on weekdays, I'm at home.
yes, I'm with you. So on this weekday of May 9th, Thursday, May 9th, show a little love for Give STL Day. And then, because that's not nearly enough, you can also get involved with Freedom Summer STL. There's been some exciting public announcements about Freedom Summer at this point. Deaconess Foundation is lending amazing support to Freedom Summer. There was an article in The American about that. And there are so many amazing partners, including Action St. Louis and Freedom Community Center and Homes for All and Missouri Voter Protection Coalition. And there are going to be far more than I could possibly list here that'll be part of our resource fair. The dates for Freedom Summer are June 19th, kicking off on Juneteenth in, drum roll please, Fairground Park in North St. Louis, right off of North Grand at Kossuth. We'll be right in that northeast corner. And it'll be great on June 19th, then June 29th. I'm going to hold the location from you right now just so you keep listening. But we're going to have another really exciting location on June 29th. And then July 27th, I'm sorry, we'll be running back with the same programming, amazing programming resources. In a third location, we're moving all over the region, and then a march and rally on August 30th. So we will keep reminding you of this. For more information or to volunteer, to be a part of it, to connect your organization, you can go to archcitydefenders.org and looking for Freedom Summer. You'll either see a banner at the top of the page. If you scroll to the bottom, you'll see some news about that announcement. You can find the link on either one of those to get involved.
Amazing.
And then, Kayla.
And then after you go to your after you join us in Fairground Park on June 19th, the next day, we are having, Action St. Louis is having a concert. We are calling it Lou Sounds. We have secured our headliner, drum roll please, the one and only Murphy Lee. I'm from the and a set of really amazing local artists. So we're going to put on a phenomenal concert. We're going to have some of our partner organizations tabling. It's going to be great. We're going to have, you know, just a really good time. That's on Thursday, June 20th at the Hawthorne. And you can find tickets at actionstl.org.
I cannot wait. I'm going to be in my millennial bag. Like,
it's going to be such a time. That whole week is just going to be like such a good week of like joyous freedom, art, culture, fun.
Yes. And last but not least, so that's a lot, you know, we're throwing a lot at you this summer. You can take a little bit of a breather, but mark your calendars for October 5th, 15-year anniversary. Wow. For Arch City Defenders celebration at the Science Center. If you are not on our newsletter, it is time to get on our newsletter. Please hold that date.
Hopefully already got a save the date via email, and we will be sending much more information. We're working on special guests. We're working on program. It's going to be past, present, future themed, and it's going to be a really good time. So hold that date, October 5th.
Yes, so much. We brought you so much goodness. We're going to have such a good time. See, we do the work, and we also party. You know what I'm saying? Party. We also have a good time. And so join us in all of those activations and opportunities. And, you know, before we wrap, because these credits have been long, we want to thank our team. You know, we want to thank Johnny. We want to thank Angelo. We want to thank Z. We want to thank Zoe. We want to thank our Music Minute, Tech Supreme, Meant to Be, where you can find on all streaming services. And we want to thank you, our listeners.
Yes. Yes. And let us know if you're enjoying it, if you have thoughts, if you have suggestions, if you have any feedback, drop us a note. We would love to hear it. Rate us. We would love 5 stars.
But please,
let us know what you think. And yes, we will be back with you very soon. I'm gonna drop just a little teaser. Next time you hear from us, we're gonna talk a little bit about the workhouse. We know you wanted to talk about the workhouse. That's what we're gonna do. So keep us in the queue. We will be back with you soon. Thank you for listening. And you have been listening to Under the Arch.
Talk to you soon. We have come so far, so far to go.